Hello and welcome to the 4Putts Podcast presented by GolfWeek.com. I'm your host, David Dusek, and in this episode, my very special guest is Ted Scott. Ted, as you probably are well aware, is the caddy for Bubba Watson, a two-time Masters champion. And in the podcast you're about to hear, he and I discuss why it all comes back to foosball. Yes, foosball. We also talk at length about how he got started in the game of golf, how he got started as a caddy, working for Paul Azinger, and then how he eventually got on the bag for Bubba Watson. And Ted gives us some insight onto not just Bubba Watson's approach to the PGA Tour, but he gives some really interesting stories about Bubba's win at the 2010 Travelers and why that was so special, the 2012 Masters, obviously that one was special, as well as the 2014 Masters, Ryder Cups, and what Ted is thinking we're probably going to see at a November Masters. Get stronger, hit longer, and end pain with Golf Forever. Created by Justin Leonard and co-author of the Younger Next Year Back book, Dr. Jeremy James, Golf Forever is the take anywhere online golf fitness program that helps you build a body primed for golf. It's simple, safe, and it works. At home, in the gym, on the golf course, Golf Forever's easy to follow exercises, warm-up routines, and course management videos will help you play your best pain-free. Sign up today at golfforever.com and use promo code GOLFWEEK for a free 14-day trial. And now I'd like to welcome to the 4Putts Podcast my good buddy and the caddy for Bubba Watson, Ted Scott. Ted, how you doing, pal?
I'm great, David. Thanks for having me. It's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you as well. And before we get into some of the things that you've been up to and the return to golf and looking forward to a Masters in November, which is almost like a Christmas coming about a month early, I got to ask you a little bit about things going on at home. It's been a very rough storm season for the folks down there where you live in Louisiana and across the Gulf Coast. What's the situation like at home, and how is everybody?
Yeah, you know, we're blessed to be alive, and we, you know, fortunately didn't take too bad a damage where I live. You know, if you go an hour west of where I am, it's complete destruction and devastation. You know, lots of my friends, a few family members, you know, that have had to totally pretty much scrap their homes, their businesses, you know, so it's pretty incredible. You know, after the U.S. Open, I had 3 weeks off, and in those 3 weeks, I had two hurricane cleanups, so that was kind of crazy, and that's not even the one that was an hour west of me. I flew to my mom's in Alabama, you know, for that hurricane, and then, you know, right before I came here to the Zozo Championship and the CJ Cup, you know, one came right pretty much, you know, within an hour of my house again. So, been kind of nuts, but, you know, we're used to it. They come in waves, you know, every probably 5 to 10 years, you know, it seems like two of them show up in Louisiana, and then we pick up the scraps and get after it again. So, you know, it's kind of a good thing in certain ways in that, people put their political differences aside and all the garbage that's going on in the world and, you know, truly help one another. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of 9/11, how the country is united, you know, in tragedy, and these things, you know, really do unite people. It doesn't matter your economic status or your race or any of that, political beliefs, you know, people just want to help each other out and get back to some sort of normalcy. So it's a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, I would agree. In some ways, as a person who was in New York during 9/11, when you were just describing that situation, it immediately flashed into my mind. It's a real pity that sometimes it takes something terrible to sort of bring everybody together. You'd like to think that we could be a little bit better than that more often. But I 100% agree. A lot of times when something really tragic or life-threatening, all of a sudden it's like your brain and collectively our brains snap back into what our priorities really should be, which is looking out for each other, helping everybody when we can, and just doing, as I sort of tell my kids, like just try and do the next right thing. You know, whatever happens to be, just try and do the next right thing.
Absolutely.
String a few of those things along, and lo and behold, some real good stuff can happen for you. So people obviously know you at this point as being Bubba Watson's caddy. You get a lot of FaceTime out there on TV. You've been in some really big situations. But what was it that got you into this? I know that you were a player. I've done a little bit of research, and you and I have chatted over the years. Talk to people who may not be aware about your playing career and how you sort of got started in the game.
Yeah, so the way I got started was, you know, we would spend the typical holidays, Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, with my grandparents, in Alexandria, Louisiana. And, My parents were split up when I was a kid, so we would go visit my dad and go there, and you know, they would take me to play golf usually like once every, you know, during one of those vacations we go out and play golf. So at 7 years old was the first time I touched a club, and I enjoyed it. And then I started spending the summertime with my dad, and I would play golf all summer long, and then I would go back to my mom's house, and we didn't have a golf course, you know, really close by, so I didn't play in the winters. And then we moved back to Lafayette, Louisiana, and you know, right before high school, and I started playing year round. Went my first semester of college to McNeese State, you know, as a walk on. They redshirted me. I really wasn't that good, and I didn't think they were that good. So I decided to come back to the Raging Cajuns in Lafayette, Louisiana. And I spoke to the coach there, and I said, "Hey, is there any chance I could walk on, you know, right here in my home city?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, it had to be your sophomore year." So I was like, "Great." And then in that time period off of one semester, I actually picked up a game called foosball, and I quit playing golf for 3.5 years. I didn't walk on. I didn't touch a club. I just competed in foosball. And then after college, started playing golf again, you know, some amateur tournaments, having some fun. A lot of my friends asked me to help them with their game. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, you know, in life. And so I started teaching. And while I was teaching, I was playing pretty well at the time. And a man that I'd played a few rounds with, you know, said, "You should try to play." And I said, "Well, it's pretty expensive to play the mini tours." And he said, "Well, I have money." I said, "Well, you're my new partner." So,
yep.
So he gave me some money. I played 6 events in 1999. You know, quickly realized that I need to sharpen my toolbox a lot. You know, you know, I was good at my home course, but you know, you got to take your game to every course. So in March of 2000, you know, I was waiting tables at night and practicing during the day, preparing for that year on the mini tours. And the web.com tournament comes through my hometown every year. And, you know, my philosophy, someone taught me when I was young that if you want to get better at something, you get around people who are better than you. So I decided to pursue that and try to go caddy for the week to see what these guys were really good at and see if I noticed something that I needed to work on that stood out. And, you know, that week I happened to pick up a guy named Grant Waite, and he asked me to do it again the following week. And before you know it, you know, a few months later, I'm standing there going toe-to-toe with Tiger Woods in 2000 at the Canadian Open, where many people say he hit his best shot ever. And, you know, we had finished second 2 weeks in a row, and I was like, "Man, this isn't a bad way to make a living," you know. So I never went back to play, and I still love to try to get in an event as soon as possible and anytime I can, because, I want to be nervous. I want to be able to relate to what my pro's going through. But, you know, I didn't really have much of a playing career, you know, didn't play much college, didn't ever play a college tournament, and really, you know, never gave it a full-time run on the mini tours. But I still am trying to improve and figure it out so I can help others, you know, who are pursuing that stuff.
So there's a lot of meat on that bone right there, and I can't bury the lead on that. Foosball, if I'm not mistaken, so we're talking like on the table with the little mini soccer players on the sticks with the ball?
That's correct.
there's, and I'm not belittling it in the least. I had no idea there was even like, are there tournaments for this? This is something that's beyond just like in people's dens, obviously. Like what was that like?
Yeah. So basically my neighbor in high school owned a pool hall, and, I had enough credits to graduate where I didn't need to go to my final hour in high school. So I would go every day in there and shoot pool. And the third best player in the state of Louisiana was teaching me how to play 9-ball. You know, during my last hour of school, I would just shoot pool every day. And then, but I wasn't old enough to be in there after 6 p.m. Back from college, I was old enough to be in there after 6 p.m. Yep. And I was in there playing pool every night. And every Monday and Thursday night, there would be, you know, 30 or 40 people crowded around a set of foosball tables, just screaming and hollering. And the curiosity that killed the cat, you know, drew me over there. And, you know, I was like, "What is this game?" And I could not believe the skill that these guys had. And so I just tapped the guy on the shoulder and said, "Excuse me, can you teach me how to do this?" And he said, "No, but I know a guy that can." So I met the tournament, you know, host, and he said, "Look, I'll teach you. You just have to play in my tournament." I said, "Well, how much does that cost?" He said, $5. I said, "I'm in." So from day one, he was a Texas State champion. He taught me how to play. And, you know, in the course of 2.5 years and picking up a really good player, a local player under his tutelage, we won 3 state doubles titles and the world amateur double title in 1994. And I won 1 single state championship. So, it's pretty incredible. It's hard to believe. Yes, there is an underground world, but I recommend looking at there's a documentary that played on ESPN during the pandemic. It's called Foosballers. And, everybody that's seen it, I'm all in. It's fascinating. So I would recommend watching that. You'll get a clue on what I'm talking about. It's really incredible.
I am all in. And I mean, now it is former world champion, Ted Scott. You can just leave off like, you know, foosball or track and field or whatever. Former world champion, Ted Scott. So you never really went through a period, it sounds like, where you needed to make a decision because of such early success with Grant, whether like caddying could be something that could end up being what pays the bills and helps you maybe put away a little something for the future, because it sounds like you and Grant get together and have, relatively speaking, some pretty immediate success, right?
Yeah, you know, Grant was such a great ball striker and great swinger of the club, and I had an incredible short game back then. I lived and breathed. That was my meat and potatoes, you know, just trying to find my golf ball, and then once I find it, I could get it in the hole pretty quick. Hopefully I could find it. So, you know, for me, it was the knowledge that he was giving me on how to swing, you know, how to approach, you know, the getting better at the swing part, and then his knowledge of, obviously, you know, course management and things like that, you know. So it was like, man, I want to do this for a little while and just soak it up as long as he's willing to have me, you know, and I think I was helping him with his putting and stuff. So it was kind of a, you know, he was getting something, I was getting something. And then, you know, I started to realize how good these guys really are and how far away I was. You know, you can go shoot in the 60s consistently on your home course, but, you know, I'm looking at these courses going, there's no way I could do that. You know, I'm so far from being this good. And so, you know, it was an opportunity for me to recognize that I'm really not that good. Even though I'm good locally, I'm not that good, you know, on a national level. And either I've got to improve a ton or I need to just do something else. And, you know, when I got engaged and ended up getting married and had our first kid, and, you know, those are things you just go, yeah, I'll just stick to doing this. It's fun. It's exciting. You know, you still feel some pressure. You still feel part of the team. And, you know, I get to do something that I love and very thankful for.
How did you hook up with Paul Azinger? Because if I'm not mistaken, that was your next bag, right?
Yeah, believe it or not, in 2002, one of the TaylorMade reps came up to me and said, hey, you need to go play Paul Azinger in foosball. He said he can beat anybody. So I went up to him and said, hey, I heard you want to play me in foosball. He's like, no, I don't want to play you. I said, well, okay. I didn't even know him. He's like, there's this guy that I can't beat. And I just want to beat that guy. And so I was like, well, I can help you with that. So we went and played one night, the week that Craig Perks won the Players Championship. And he couldn't believe the skill that, you know, that you could possibly have on a foosball table. And he fell in love with it. He invited me to his house for a week. I went and taught him foosball. He worked with me on my game. You know, and then next thing you know, I'd split with Grant to actually go back to playing because of Paul. I think I played two rounds with him, and I lit it up that week I was there, and he's like, you need to be playing golf for a living. So I quit caddying and started to go back to the mini tours. And then he asked me to caddy for 1 week, you know, in Flint, Michigan, because every night they have incredible foosball, you know, games, just matches. And so he's like, you got to come caddy this week. We're going to have matches every night. And, he'd only made two cuts all year. He was struggling with his putting. I gave him a putting tip and he finished seventh. And he's like, you want to caddy again at the PGA? And before you know it, I was back caddying again, you know, cause I wasn't playing that well in the few tournaments I went at again, you know? So, just kind of random, you know, how it all worked out.
It's the way life works sometimes. It's just, you know, some things sort of fall into place and it's like, you know, it's just fate and it just happens to work out. So how do you then go from Paul Azinger to Bubba Watson? Where was the connection and how'd that happen?
Yeah, so I would say I'm a pretty good employee, you know, and I'm loyal. I show up every day. I don't call in sick. I think I do a decent job. And the only job I've ever been fired from is from Paul Azinger. So,
ouch.
And what's so funny about it is, I mean, he's incredible to work for. I mean, like, you know, anybody that's ever worked for Paul would say he's such a great boss. I mean, very generous with his money, you know, very good attitude, a fighter, never blames you. He was just pretty much, you know, his back was hurting. He wasn't playing good and he was miserable. He's like, you know, I don't have it anymore. And he said, I'm firing you. And, you know, I was like, oh, okay. And I was getting ready 2 months away from having our first child, you know, my wife and I. And so I was like, okay. So I didn't really want a caddy after that. I was going to go into business with my brother-in-law because there was really nobody I wanted to work for. I want to have fun. And, there was some of the players that were maybe available at the time. I was like, yeah, I don't really think I would enjoy working for that person.
right?
As much as I did with Paul. I mean, he was so fun and very competitive, you know, even though he didn't have his A game. So anyway, basically I just called a couple of buddies and said, look, if you hear of somebody, you know, let me know. If not, you know, I got some other things I'm going to do. And
right.
Got a call from Ben Crane. I knew him from the PGA Tour Bible Study, and Bubba knew him from the PGA Tour Bible Study. And Bubba and I had never met. And he said, hey, you know, I got a guy that, that I think would be good for you, Bubba. And so Ben called me and said, would you want to work for Bubba Watson? I said, yeah, I don't know anything about the guy other than I hear he hits it far and curves it, you know? And, so we set up a 2-week trial run, you know, blind date. And, we finished like 11th and 12th the first 2 weeks, and I got the job, and here we are in our 15th season. So it's pretty crazy how that worked out.
Sitting there whining at each other like an old married couple. It's just perfect. You know,
exactly.
It's great. It's great stuff. So I think, obviously Bubba Watson's big year, you're both, I should say, you guys are a team, big year, 2010. He gets his first win. Happens to be my home event up here at the Travelers Championship, TPC River Highlands. I remember it vividly. I'm sure you do too. What do you remember most about that week and him finally breaking through with the win?
Yeah, so, you know, that was one of the toughest years that I worked with Bubba. You know, that year in 2013 were very difficult. And, you know, mainly because he was putting himself under a tremendous amount of stress. You know, his dad was dying of cancer, and yeah, he wanted to win on the PGA Tour before his dad passed away to honor his dad, who, you know, he got him into golf and did all his golf mm-hmm. with. So he was just high strung, you know, he was young and mature. And, you know, 2 weeks before we had done the US Open qualifier, a few weeks before. And, you know, pretty much I just told him at the end of that qualifier that I was done caddy and I didn't want to work for him anymore because, you know, he was having such a poor attitude on the course. And I said, the only way I would continue to work is if he changed that. And he looked me right in the eyes. I thought he would say, hey, you're fired, you know, fine, go get out of here, punk. And he said, yeah. You're absolutely right. And I'm sorry. And I said, perfect. I mean, that's all I can ever ask of anyone is to do like you told your kids, you know, just make a better decision coming up, you know? And so that's all I'm looking for is hope. And he was great. And so I said, okay, perfect. So, you know, we went to the Travelers, and it was the first time that he decided he was going to have a good attitude no matter what came down the pipe. And interestingly enough, we were on the 27th hole, our ninth hole of the tournament, and he started to flip out again. And I stopped him and I said, listen, the clubhouse is right there. I will walk in. You know, you said 2 weeks ago that you were going to commit to this. Let me know what's the deal. And he said, yep, you're right. My bad. And he was an angel, you know, and he ended up winning his first tournament. And, you know, the tears and the joy of that really came from, you know, all the passion that he had for his dad and the love he had for his dad and wanting to do it for his dad. You know, that emotion came out. So, you know, incredible week, incredible experience. You know, I'm getting teary-eyed right now just thinking about it, you know, what that meant to him and how important that was.
Well, and you explain the story that way. I mean, there's so many different layers. I mean, a lot of people, when they look at a PGA Tour event and they're watching on TV, as unfortunately most of us now are, there's nobody who's going to be at PGA Tour events right now. I guess they're going to be whatever, but you see what the television and what the story that CBS or ESPN or whatever golf channel is showing you, but there's always more to the story that you don't see. And they did a good, I remember it vividly, a great job of explaining why that was so important for Bubba. They talked about, you know, his father and obviously, like, you know, he lost it emotionally, but to hear that, you know, on the 27th hole of a tournament that he would go on to win, that the wheels almost came off and that there were these moments where it wasn't perfect, and it's never perfect out there, but it's fascinating to hear you talk about that. Later that same season, you guys are in a playoff at the PGA Championship, and I apologize so I went back and I watched that up on YouTube. YouTube's great. You can just go back and just check out all this stuff and something. Were you on the bag there? Because it didn't look like you.
No,
I don't know if maybe.
No, it wasn't me. It was Mark Cairns, you know, one of my best
friends.
That's
what I thought.
On the tour, and Mark's, you know, Mark's pro was struggling that year. And I, you know, I told Bubba, I said, look, I want to be there for the birth of my son, you know, mm-hmm. you know, so if it works out. And so actually 2 weeks in a row, you know, I didn't work. And that was the second of those 2 weeks.
So I'm sitting there watching YouTube and I'm like, this is not Ted, unless like the camera angles are really whacked out and he just lost about 7 or 8 inches in height. You know, it's just not him. Bubba obviously has a great week. Loses to Martin Keimer in that playoff. And were you watching at the time? Because what eventually, for people who don't recall it, Bubba played great. Obviously, Martin was out of his head, made tons of putts, and was wonderful, deserving champion. The key moment comes down to in the playoff, they're tied playing in an aggregate playoff. Bubba hits his drive into the right rough, and then a shot comes up short, and he goes into the water on the 18th green, and that really opened the door for Martin to win the tournament. And I'm sitting here reliving this, having forgotten that moment. If you're watching at home and you watch this, what goes through your head in terms of like, oh my gosh, that's the wrong club or the wrong play, or obviously disappointment for the team? Were you watching at the time, and what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I was busy on Sunday, and then I heard that they were very close to the lead with like three holes to play. And, I'm ashamed to say I was driving 95 miles an hour to get home to watch it. obviously a very big fan of Mark Cairns. I mean, like I said, one of my best friends out here, and he was not having a good year financially, and he has a family. And, my thing was, man, I want him to win so he can get some money and provide for his family. I was super pumped about that. That was my number one thing, was like, man, how cool would that be, And so I showed up, I saw the last few holes as well as the playoff. And, Mark Cairns is a great caddy and Bubba's a great player. And so, I wasn't second guessing any decision that they made. I mean, after talking to him afterwards, they both thought that they were going to catch a flyer. And that's the risk that you take, when you're trying to win something. And a lot of people who've never been in that situation don't understand. They think people choke or whatever, but the problem with being great at anything is that you have to be willing to mess up in order to gain something. And most people who have never been great at anything are never willing to take that risk to actually get something from it. It's like starting a business, right? It's a tremendous risk to take on that pressure and that stress, but the upside is where it comes from. Or you can say, well, I'm just going to stay in my comfort zone and not do that. And so, being a great champion, you have to be willing to hit the shot that's called for. And sometimes it's a guess. The ball, one blade of grass makes the ball go farther or not farther, and that's kind of hard to tell. So, just an unfortunate thing. I mean, Bubba hit it right at the pin. It just didn't fly like they thought.
It was online the whole way. It ended up being, you watch it on the replay and it's 20 yards short of the putting surface and you're like, oh my gosh. And the announcer's like, he missed clubbed or this or that. And as you're saying, he's the one hitting the shot. He's the one that's standing over it. And he and his caddy are making that decision. And fear can do some really funny things to people, in athletic competition and in life in general. In athletic competitions, it can change the way your body's working. You get a shot of adrenaline, and all of a sudden every club in the bag is 10 yards longer.
Yeah,
or it
sure.
can, in some cases, be restrictive. And all of a sudden you lose flow, and you're 10 yards shorter than you would be because you seize up. I mean, these cliches that people use sometimes to describe things are there because there's a level of accuracy to it, that you get guys who just get amped out and some people who get tight. And It was a really great performance by him in a major championship that didn't go well. 2012, different story. Aside from the unbelievable shot that he hits in the playoff on 10 at the Masters to win his first green jacket, what do you recall most, or what comes into your mind most when you think back to the 2012 Masters?
Yeah, so, a few months before, Bubba kind of started planting a seed in his own head, and watering it. He would say to me periodically, man, I think I can win Augusta, and that's a good thing when someone starts believing, that something's possible.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the beginning of it, was just starting to say, how much he loved it, how much he thought the course fit him. He just loves everything about it, and that he thinks he can win it. So when you have that, that belief inside of you, and then you love the way it, sets up for your game and all the shots and the creativity that, he's known for, you kind of felt like it was going to be a good week. And also, it's easier to take the bumps, the licks, whenever you think there's going to be a good result at the end. It's kind of like working out, right? If you're going to the beach in 6 months, you're willing to push things really hard, away from you. Even though it's hurt, you get lactic acid built up, you're willing to do that stuff because you recognize that you might get something from it, you know? So, there's just a calmness and a relaxation, no matter what happened. I never had to say, come on, man, you know, it was just, he was in it. So from the get go, you know, so that's kind of what I remember the most about that week, was just the presence, you know, of his mind and how focused he was and how nothing bothered him, you know, nothing.
The Sneak is a true crime podcast from For the Win in USA Today, and this season is on a surfing champion whose life took a violent, tragic turn.
Within 30 seconds, they're both dead.
The Sneak, Murders at Whiskey Creek, is out July 29th, wherever you get podcasts.
So players talk, and, you know, obviously the media talks to players about how special that tournament is. It's the one major championship, obviously, every year where we go back to the same place. This year we're doing it later in the year than we typically do, but it's great that we get to have it here in a few weeks. From a caddy perspective, talk to me about how the Masters is different from not just week-to-week PGA Tour events, but the other events. You guys have a great location just to the side of the range, where I know that there's a wonderful pavilion for you guys to stay there, but as the week sort of progresses and takes shape, how is it different at Augusta National than it is at other venues?
Yeah, you know, I think it's almost like, in a sense, you know, you think of iconic golf courses where great champions have played, and you have very memorable shots, you know, Pebble, St. Andrews, things like that, where you just kind of go, man, you remember when, you know, Jack Nicklaus did this, or Tom Watson, or whatever. You know, so when you go to Augusta, you kind of remember all the things that have happened, you know, oh, this is where Chip chipped in, and this is where, you know, this happened, you know. So it's to begin with, it's just like the prestige and the history of the place. Whereas when you go to a major championship where they've played it twice and you don't really remember it, it's just kind of feels like a golf tournament, you know, that's a little more pressure and a lot tougher. Mm-hmm. But when you go to Augusta, you know, it's like right away, you're at Wimbledon, you know, where the great champions have played, you know, in tennis, and the history of, you know, all the greats that have been there and all the shots that have happened. And so, the atmosphere, the back nine on Sunday atmosphere, is something that you can't even describe, you know, especially when you're playing the front nine and you can hear it, you know, early on, you know, just how enthusiastic the patrons are, and you know, the way they set the course up for the drama, you know, it's perfect setting to play incredible or play terrible. You know, you can quickly lose it and you can shoot four under, which is exciting. You know, it's not just a par fest, you know, hang on. Okay, let's just try to keep making pars and hopefully keep our lead. You know, I mean, there's usually a run on Sunday in the back nine, and that makes it very exciting. So, you know, it's just, I think the history and the prestige of the tournament, and then, you know, there's not one thing that they do that's not first class, you know, at Augusta. I mean, you go there, you know, my dad, first time we ever went, you know, he was like, there's not a blade of grass out of place, you know. And so, you know, you know, the golf course is going to be immaculate. You know, the food's going to be great, the staff, you know, everything's going to be clean. You know, the patrons are very well behaved there, which is fun. You know, you don't feel like that they're trying to interrupt you or be a part of the story, you know, screaming in your backswing or whatever, you know. So it's just a very prestigious golf tournament with a great history, and, you know, it's beautiful. So it's hard to describe, you know, any other place like it.
Sounds like a good gig. Do you have the flag from 18 from that year?
Yes, sir. I do.
That's do you also have your own? This is always something that I'm fascinated by.
Let me correct myself on that. I actually have the flag from hole 10 on that year, and Andrew Fisher, Bubba's trainer at the time, has the flag from hole 18. We asked.
Oh, that's of course, because of the playoff.
Yeah, we asked Augusta if he could have that, and they said yes. So so he got one, and I got the one from hole 10.
Do you have like sort of a? Most of the time, players are going to have yardage books, and oftentimes their caddy will also have a book. Do you keep all of your old books and sort of go back and reference them, or is there a master book that you update over the years? Where do those go?
Yeah, no, I have several boxes at my house from 20 years of caddying, and, you know, pretty much you never throw away a yardage book, you know, in case you go back. You just never know. I mean, here we are at Sherwood this week, and, you know, I think we were here last in 14, so you're digging through there trying to find it. going, hey, what did we hit on this hole? And what about that? You know, oh man, I remember this happened. And so
I would imagine it must've felt kind of cool. One of the traditions, if I don't have it mistaken, is that the following year, the Masters champion, don't they get the number one on the caddy bib?
Yeah, they do. That's a good tradition. And yes, that is correct. Good memory.
That's got to feel really special. You sort of slide in there, and it's obviously like, you know, if you win a British Open, you get the claret jug for the year, and then you sort of hand it back as part of the tradition the following year.
Right.
other things sort of go along like that. There's got to be a big sense of pride. I mean, like all of a sudden, like that year, you're the number one, and there's this sort of acknowledgement or sort of like a little nod that like, yep, you're the guy, you're the defender. And that has to be kind of special.
Yeah, you know, they do a lot of little neat things for you, you know, that probably people don't know about. I'm not going to reveal any of that stuff, but it's great. You know, obviously winning Augusta, I mean, you know, I don't know what it's like to win any other major, but I'd take four more of those and be very pumped about it.
So 2 years after that, sandwiching around an Adam Scott victory that was also in a playoff in that year, 2013, over Angel Cabrera. You and Bubba win your second Masters. And walk me through the moments that going from 12 green on Sunday up to 13 tee box and then what you saw up there. Because that, to me, was one of the defining shots of the last 10 years. That shot at 13 on Sunday was unbelievable.
Yeah, so to go back to your point of adrenaline, you know, these guys do things when they're under adrenaline that's pretty incredible. And, you know, Jordan had struggled on hole 12, even though we were battling him. You know, he had started to struggle a little bit, which gives, you know, a lot of times it's like a cat fight, right? One person starts posturing when the other one starts shrinking. And so, I think that gave Bubba some, you know, chin up, chest out kind of, you know, attitude to begin with. You know, when Jordan hit it in the water there, and then we, you know, we had a nice storm that came through that area that year and thinned out a lot of the trees. The treetops were very, you know, thin because of that ice storm apparently. So it was just a little bit different than it typically is. And so when he hit the tee shot, you know, he pushed it, but he hit it probably as hard as any tee shot I've ever seen him hit in 15 years of watching him hit golf balls. And so, you know, when he hit it, I knew it was going to carry really far, and I thought it probably would catch a limb or two in my mind, you know, but not enough to knock it where we wouldn't find it or even to where it wouldn't be over the creek, you know. And then, you know, it's probably the only time I've ever seen a delayed reaction roar on a tee shot. It's like almost like a hole in one, you know. When that ball landed, you know, next thing you know, you hear these cheers, and you're like, is that for our tee shot? So, yeah, it was pretty ridiculous.
It was unbelievable. And I remember watching that shot thinking, oh my gosh, he's about to hand him shots back. Because as everybody sort of, you know, it's funny, because we go back every year and that golf course has been enshrined in video games, everybody knows intimately the Augusta National. And if you go left off 13, it's long, big, high trees. And as you accurately, you know, sort of described, that had been thinned out because of an ice storm that happened in the season. And I thought he's going to go up near Jake the Snake as my caddy. I had a chance to play Augusta National as after winning the media lottery in 2009. And
nice.
My caddy told me, he's like, if you lose a ball up there, we're not looking for it because that's where all the snakes are. And I was like,
well,
sounds good to me.
He's right. They are up there.
Yeah, I'm like, I got plenty of pills. Like we're going straight or we're going right, babe. We're not going up onto that hillside. And my thought when that shot went off was he's going to give it back and all of a sudden things are going to get really goofy. And it was a shot that obviously goes in there and just put him in the catbird seat. There have been a couple shots like that. Bryson shot recently at Wingfoot on 16 when he just absolutely let it rip and hit one was an iconic shot. Was that a line that you guys even discussed cutting the corner like that in practice rounds or in previous rounds? Or was it literally, as you describe it, like a block on a really hard tee shot that just happened to go that way? Was he thinking about a line like that at any point before?
Well, you know, he was definitely aiming probably, I would say, at the most 15 yards right of that and just trying to smash it. And typically when Bubba, you know, hammers it, it doesn't fade. Like when he hits his high knuckle bomb, you know, it's not a push. It's typically, if anything, it'll just go really dead straight. And so, okay, you know, he took a little more aggressive line, you know, and that's the genius of who Bubba is, you know. I mean, he's got so many shots. So no, we didn't discuss it, you know. I mean, he just gets up on the tee and, you know, that's a hole where he can hit a low chip slice and run it down the fairway. He can hit it hard, a high cut, a high bomb. You know, I've kind of seen it all. And I've seen him hit it 15 yards right of that on the line many times, you know. So, you know, like when the conditions are right, you know, whether it's in a practice round or what. But, you know, with that kind of adrenaline, you know, you're capable of maybe an extra 20 yards. The trees were a little thin, you know, and he's a very sharp guy. I'm sure he thought about all that stuff. But, no, it's not something that we personally discussed.
So, obviously, having won two major championships at that point, Bubba's in the prime, or one of the primes of his career. He certainly still has much more prime to go. But President's Cups, Ryder Cups, those kind of events start taking place. The coverage is really interesting in that there's not that much golf that gets played. For all of the pageantry and all the pressure and everything that's sort of put onto the players and the team captains, certainly, when it comes to Ryder Cups, especially, I think, that there's not that much golf that gets played, but there's so much that goes on and that's involved in it. Can you describe for people who are sort of unaware what your roles are? Because in a team situation, when you are paired with either in four ball or in foursomes, it's the whole team, the caddies are a big part of this stuff. So walk people through sort of the preparations leading up to a Ryder Cup or a President's Cup from a caddy perspective.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the few weeks where we get to be partners with someone other than your player, you know, caddy relationship. So, you know, I think it's kind of like a team building exercise for a corporation, you know, where you go on let's go to, you know, Orlando. We're going to go to Disney World for 4 days and we're going to do some team building exercises and try to, you know, build a brand that where everybody's, you know, on the same team and we're fighting together and trying to beat the others. And so, you know, so there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of bonding. There's a lot of encouraging that goes on that you just don't have in a typical individual tournament, you know? So that's the real fun part of it, is we get to be a part of something that you're normally not a part of. And, you know, you're trying to figure out strategy, whether, hey, are we going to play alternate shot? Are we going to be in the four ball? You know, what about this? Well, you want the odds or the evens? You know, how are you putting? You're putting well. Okay, well, I'll hit the irons, you know, because this course sets up where I'll hit, you know, three more iron shots and you'll have three more birdie putts, you know. So just that's the kind of strategy that goes on. But, yeah, it's, you know, behind the scenes, it's a lot of just bonding and really trying to get the energy in the right place where you feel like a team. You want to fight for one another. You want to fight for the captains. You know, and the PGA staff is, you know, unsung heroes. I mean, what they do for that event and during that event, they work so long hours and prepare it really, really well. So, you know, kudos to them for what they do. And you know, I've never had anything but an incredible experience, you know, with what they've done. So it's a lot. I mean, it really is. It's a lot for 3 days of golf. It's like, man, this is a big week. A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about social media is how much it revealed that while the players and the teams are competing like the Dickens to try and beat each other, and everybody really, really wants to win, once the event is over, there's usually a party for the American team, a party for, in this case, you know, the European team for the Ryder Cup. Eventually, those two things merge, and everybody's, for the most part, very friendly, very cordial. Everybody's getting along, having a good time. I vividly remember after one Ryder Cup that the U.S. lost, Bubba Watson and Ian Poulter smiling and taking selfies together and posting them up, you know, on Twitter and Instagram and everything sort of goes on. And it's great. During the event, what is the relationship between you and the European Tour caddies? And I ask that because for people who may not be aware, it's very common for caddies and twosomes and threesomes at PGA Tour events to assist other players. I mean, if a player hits a bunker shot, walks out, taps his spikes, and then sort of walks up onto the green, his caddy's going to go in there and clean out the bunker. At the same time, the player may drop a mark down, pick up the ball, and somebody will offer to clean it off or to help out. You're handing the flag back and forth to whoever's going to be the last one off. All this stuff to sort of keep the pace of play going, and if nothing else, just be polite. It's not you know, offering up how to read a putt, but it's just being sort of, you know, polite and cordial and stuff like that. Does that go on still in Ryder Cups, or are you guys so focused on helping out, in your case, you know, the U.S. team and your guys? Does that not really take place?
I think it definitely takes place on both sides of it. I think you have players that, you know, are different, and you have caddies that are different, and then you have caddies and players that are the same, you know, and it just depends on what motivates you, you know. You know for a fact that Webb Simpson and Paul Tesori, you know, two of the best guys you could ever meet, are never going to do any mind games. You know, that's not who they are, right? But obviously there's definitely players and caddies that will be trying to do, you know, things to get into someone else's head mentally and frustrate them and try to take you off your game. You know, it's a competition. And, you know, I think that should be welcomed as long as it's within the rules of golf. As long as you're not, you know, talking in somebody's backswing or whatever, it's like, hey, man, it's a competition. If I can intimidate you or frustrate you because I didn't want to wreck your guy's bunker or something, you know, it's not something that I would personally do. But I'm saying, you know, I don't have a problem with somebody trying to do that stuff. I mean, that's what you're out there for. And it's, you know, kill or be killed kind of thing. But, afterwards, you know, it's fun. You know, I mean, that's what makes it so fun, because it's so intense and so there's so many small stories to it. You know, it's like, I hate this guy, you know, and then you go have dinner with him afterwards, you know. So,
and that's the thing that I think a lot of people didn't really get, is that over the years there has been, I don't know if animosity is really the right word, but the intensity certainly has ratcheted up over the years with Ryder Cup. And in my opinion, sometimes on both the European and the U.S. fan side, lines have been crossed. And it disappoints me to sort of see that. And I put it on both sides of that. I'm not saying one over the other, but the intensity has gotten really, really high at times, to the point where sometimes I even question, like, you know, we need to ratchet this down. Competition, fiercely trying to win, of course, absolutely. Lines have been crossed. But I remember just vividly seeing this stuff, and what people don't think realize, and it, like I sort of said before, it's been a positive thing on the fact of social media, is that it sort of revealed the players are all really good friends by and large before the event and after the event. During, they're trying to win. But a lot of times you end up seeing pictures and hearing stories about how everybody got along, and there's like little needling here and there, and guys are sort of getting into it a little bit, but it's all in the proper nature. It's as if the players get it, but the people outside the ropes sometimes lose sight of it. One of the things, Ted, I keep, before I let you go, we've obviously got the Masters coming up here in November. It's going to be a very different, I'm assuming, type of a Masters than what we've seen before. I think we can presume the weather is going to be colder. It sounds like going off of two tees is a definite possibility because of daylight. What are you guys anticipating? How are you preparing for a November Masters?
Well, Bubba prepares by showing up at every place. So, you know, he's not a practicer. He's just, you know, he just, you know, basically just gets there. He's like, all right, let's just play golf, you know. So he doesn't hit balls. He doesn't, you know, that's just who he is, and that's how he's successful in his method. But, you know, being that the overseed will be newer, I think it'll probably be softer, you know, the roots won't be as thick and deep as they are. So I think the course will naturally be a little bit softer. So the ball, it's going to play, you know, colder. It's going to play longer, you know, for one. And two, you know, without the patrons there, you know, that's going to be different without having those huge roars, you know, when you make a putt. I mean, you know, it's something we've been dealing with this year. Very, very difficult to get into the tournament sometimes when you're close, you know, when you don't have that adrenaline or whatever. That adrenaline makes these guys focus and even do, you know, way more incredible things. So, definitely, you know, it's interesting, you know, the approach that we're going to be taking. It would be just like any other Masters, except it's not going to feel the same. You know, I can't put it past them, but I can't imagine they'd have azaleas blooming. You know?
Yeah, I mean, if any place is going to be able to make a dogwood, you know, sort of bloom in the middle of November, it would be the Augusta National. But exactly. I agree. I think I had a chance to talk with Peter Costas on the podcast last week, and he wasn't the least bit surprised, for example, that Colin Morikawa wins, obviously being a good player, that Bryson DeChambeau wins, two guys who win their first major championships and break through, relatively young players, certainly in Morikawa's case, and there are no fans. The fact that we're going to be going to a Masters, there aren't going to be patrons. You had talked earlier about the back nine atmosphere. It's going to be a very different back nine atmosphere at Augusta National this year. Would you be surprised if some of the younger players or the less experienced at Augusta National players are going to potentially be contenders? Or do you think that just the way that that golf course set up and the experience that you get playing Augusta National over the years sort of trumps the fact that maybe the roars and the adrenaline that would be a bad thing for some of the more inexperienced players isn't going to be there?
I would be surprised at Augusta. And the reason why is because I've played St. Andrews and I've played, you know, some other great golf courses. And when Bubba took me to Augusta the first time and there was nobody out there except the pro watching us tee off, he said, "You're going to be nervous on the first tee." I said, "No, I'm not. Why would I be nervous?" You know, and my hand was shaking on the first tee when I teed up at Augusta.
Yep.
So, you know what? I think it's just different. You know, the prestige, knowing that, you know, hey, lifetime exemption, the champions dinner, man, that's a big deal.
Right one to win, isn't it? If you're going to win one, that's the right one to win.
So I think, you know, I don't think it's going to be quite the same, even though there's no patrons. You know, I don't think it'll quite be as what Peter said for Augusta. I just think that, you know, it's just, it just kind of puts you in a different frame of mind. And you know, maybe in my opinion, that having patrons there would help somebody who's never won or you know, that, but that's just my take.
Listen, Ted, I know you've got to bounce and got to go. Best of luck with the end of the 2020 season. Hopefully you guys have a little reprieve from all the storms that have been happening back home. And once again, thanks very much for coming on the Four Press.
David, you're the man. I appreciate it.